important to me as a young mother to try to give to my son the poetry of the world, to explain to him that while a larger society not only was willing to neglect him, but to abuse him, that there were members of that larger society who understood something about being human. And so I taught him the poem Invictus at about 8 years old, so that he would stand with his very fine chest about that big and say Invictus. Out of the night that covers me black as a pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul.
In the fell clutch of circumstance,
I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeoning of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the master.
I didn't know this was going to be a roast.
But it was wonderful. And it's so important to young men and women, 8 and 10, the age of my little grandson, Elliot. It is very important. And a niece of mine, Stevie. It's very important for them to have the words so that they can say them. Because believe it, they are watching and listening to other people who are saying things about them and their sexuality and their sensuality, which will kill them. They are listening to some people who are very popular and who are on MTV or on the various and sundry programs, who use words that are meant to debase them. So they need to have something which lifts them up, that tells them, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, yet make allowance for their doubting too, if you can make one heap of all your earnings. And it was very, I'm sorry.
No, please. I do.
It was very important, and it is still important. Poetry and poets go in and out of fashion. But the need to have something which lifts up the human spirit and encourages the person not only to survive, but to thrive, and to thrive with some passion, some compassion, some humor, and some style. Very important.
Yes. Yes.
So, with that, in a slightly deeper voice, as age brings us all, I'd like to read Claude McKay, If We Must Die, because this poem, too, was part of that backbone that was put in line by line. If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and pinned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock of our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us die nobly, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their 1,000 blows deal 1 death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back.
That poem. poem has such a history. Claude McKay wrote it in 1919, a black man, Caribbean, West Indian man. He wrote it in 1919. It is very interesting that when Winston Churchill came to the United States in the late 30s, early 40s, attempting to encourage the American people to join the war, World War II, he spoke at the House of Representatives. And after he finished speaking, as he wound down this speech of such import and such passion, he said, "If we must die, then let us nobly die." I'm certain that he had no idea that he was using the words of an African in the diaspora. I'm sure of that. It's right. Very interesting to see the life of a poet. When Mr. George Jackson was killed and the ceremony took place here in Oakland, I came out to cover the funeral for Harper's Magazine. And the Panthers, along with Miss Angela Davis, had the ceremony here in West Oakland. And they said that they only wanted one piece of poetry used, and that was, "If we must die, then let us nobly die. Not hunted and pinned in some inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot." So here's a poem. Look at it. A West Indian man wrote it in 1919. It was of use then to Winston Churchill, later of use to the Panther Party, and now it used here at the Calvin Simmons Hall. Look at a piece of poetry. Yeah.
We're talking about sons and daughters. I have a daughter who is 27, going on 75. And it is exhausting. And it's most, you know, it's most amusing when she looks at me and she says, "Oh, Mom, I didn't know that you could dance like that." Or, "Oh, Mom, I didn't know that you could talk like that. Do you have all your teeth?" So I have, this is, of course, my favorite poet. Perhaps you know her. Her name is Dr. Maya Angelou. And it's a wonderful poem on aging, and I read it when I lose patience. "When you see me sitting quietly like a sack left on the shelf, don't think I need your chattering. I'm listening to myself. Hold, stop, don't pity me. Hold, stop, your sympathy. Understanding if you've got it. Otherwise, I'll do without it. When my bones are stiff and aching and my feet won't climb the stair, I will only ask one favor. Don't bring me no rocking chair. When you see me walking, stumbling, don't study and get it wrong, because tired don't mean lazy, and every goodbye ain't gone. Hey. I'm the same person I was back then, a little less hair, a little less chin, a lot less lungs, and much less wind. But ain't I lucky I can still breathe in."
I grew up in a little town in Arkansas, much smaller than this stage, and I was a mute for about 6 years, from 7 till about 13. And black children in my little town, and even in North Carolina where I live today, still perform in church. But at that time, children would do four little lines of doggerel. It was, "What you looking at me for? I didn't come to stay. I just come to tell you this is some kind old man or woman in the church would lean forward and say, "Christmas, honey." And the child would say, "Christmas Day," and get off the platform. And all the old folks would say, "Didn't he do sweetly?" Oh, bless her heart, she did so nicely. But during that time, I had memorized everybody. Hmm. I just didn't talk. But I had memorized Pauline Dunbar and James Weldon Johnson and County Cullen and Langston Hughes. I had it, and Edgar Allan Poe. I loved Poe so much, I called him Eat. So I taught him to my son. And I thought, you know, this was all those years ago. I didn't know that Poe wasn't in rhythm. It was rhythm to me. So I taught him, "Once upon a midnight dreary, as I wandered weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, as I nodded, almost napping, suddenly I heard a tap, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door, merely this, and nothing more."
Ah, distinctly, I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for that rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore.
And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of the purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with a fantastic terror never felt before, so that now to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. Some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. Merely this, and nothing more."
Presently, my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore. But the fact was I was napping, as you so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more."
Deep into that darkness peering long, I stood there wandering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before, till my heart, I said, "Open." Then I flung the shutter, and with many a flirt and flutter, in there walked a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a moment stopped a stady, but with mane of lord or lady, he perched above my chamber door. He perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door. He perched and sat and nothing more.
Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. "Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou," said I, "art sure no craven, ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, wandering on the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore."
Startled by this darkness, spoken by a reply so aptly spoken, what I said, what it utters is its only stock and store, caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster had followed fast and followed faster, till the burden of his song one melancholy burden bore, and that was never more.
Mom is doing it. But the raven, sitting lonely on a placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if in his soul that one word he did outpour. Nothing further than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, "Other friends have flown before, and on the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore." So we're hopping.
No. So, I started by the stillness broken. What's the next one?
Okay. Do right here. But the raven's still broken.
But the raven's sitting lonely on that pallet bus, said only that one word, as if his soul from that one word it did outpour. Then I pushed a cushioned seat under the bird and the bus and the door. Then upon that velvet sinking, I took myself to thinking, fancy unto fancy, thinking, what this ominous bird of yore, what this gaunt and grim and ugly ominous bird of yore meant by croaking nevermore. No.
Methought the air grew denser, perfumed from some unseen censer, swung by seraphims whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. "Wretch," I cried, "thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff and quaff this old nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore." Quoth the raven, "Nevermore."
Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked, upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore, and leave no black plume as a token of the lie thy soul has spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken, and quit the bust above my door. Take thy beat from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door. And I quote the raven, "Nevermore." Young with a person and really live the poetry with him or her, him and her. The people grow up with some, what my grandmother used to call starch, in their backbone. They find they can walk into places. That is, young black men and black women, Asian men and women, Spanish speaking men and women, white American men and women, Anglos, they learn that, oh, I see, I am a human being, so nothing human can be alien to me. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, very early on, I taught Guy Johnson some Shakespearean sonnets. And one which meant a lot to me and still does is the sonnet I learned at about 10. I was in Arkansas, in that little village. I was a mute. I had been raped and abused in so many ways. But then I read this poem. I couldn't believe a white person, and a man at that, could know what it was like to be a black girl, isolated. And the sonnet is, "When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone bemoan my outcast state and trouble a deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed. I'm desiring that man's art and that man's scope, and with what I most enjoy, contented lease. When in these thoughts myself almost despising, happy, I think on thee. And then my state is like to the lark. At break of day arising from sullen earth, I sing hymns at heaven's gate. For my, thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings that I would scorn to change my state with king.
Jen, would you do the first juncture?
Yes, Jen.
Please.
Janice Midikitani, one of my favorite poets.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Shifu.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't quite know how to tell you what an honor it is to be on the same platform with Dr. Maya Angelou and Guy Johnson, but I also know that I have been strengthened by them because they are my family. And I think that this is a family affair. So I want to read a poem to Guy Johnson on the occasion of his 50th birthday. And I also want to read a poem that I read to wrote to Dr. Angelou. You know, I realized as I was doing it how dangerous it is to read this woman's poem. I mean, my God. But I'd like to start my section here by reading a poem to my husband.
Yes.
Who is not with us tonight because he's ill. And he sends you his love and good wishes for a happy birthday. And thank you so much to Dr. Angelou for supporting Glide Church last evening. It was an incredible success. And she was phenomenal. excuse me. You know, Dr. Angelou opened my cage door when I read her, and she taught me the power of the word, of revealing the truth. I myself had been incested and molested for 11 years of my childhood and did not understand how liberating telling the truth could be. So I spoke for the first time about that experience at Glide Church before a congregation of people I knew and people I didn't know, and it was quite incredible. Yeah, Cecil Williams, you know, is the minister of Glide Church, and he has quite an incredible, diverse congregation and an incredibly open platform, and somehow he makes it quite safe for us to say who we are and say who we've been. And this poem entitled War of the Body, if I can find it, is dedicated to him and his liberating love. War of the Body for Cecil. I'd hoped for a truce, not believing it possible, this protracted war with my body, so long waged, hating my breasts that stung to the touch, this flat body, frigid as a bivouac. I had feared no marriage could survive my demolition. From her childhood, the invasions of male artillery, without warning at night, when stars were hidden, excavated, scud-missiled her. Like a prisoner of war, she crept into sweet, unchallenging silence where she could escape, leave from the village of her body and watch it burn from a distance. She wished the mothers would rescue the children, at least, clutch them to their backs and carry them to safety. But he quickly scattered them like a fallen nest, broken eggshells, twigs, feathers, crushed by his heavy boot heel. He grinds the child into the soft wood of her cage until her back is a wall of slivers. He captures chickens, rubs his fingers into them, molests the kittens, the dogs in heat, as they hiss, howl, often die. He laughs, knowing that the child sees. I tell you these memories, yielding my silence like a weapon as we vault through minefields of marriage, my rage meaner than mortar, thoughtless as prison food. My body, like a burn victim, is cauterized shut. I tell you in the warm sunlight of morning, your eyes swarming like bees, you say the dead can spring from our throats. You have laid your face into burnt soil, seen leaves rotting like flesh, but from the bones sprout lavender, henna, and elm. You whisper Isaiah to me. Rain does not return to heaven until it waters earth. Everything is useful. Come, you say, bring your slivered wall, your burned village, your amputated sex, the prisons of silence, your torn bird, to my sanctuary. No secret is too shameful. Place your soiled breasts into the nest of my hands. Truth is not punished here, in this demilitarized zone, where you are not a segregated woman, but an integrity of light. My body, in the forest of your arms, becomes unseparated as I pull your mouth to my throat so that I may have two tongues. I breathe with your breathing. My flesh opens unstitched. Hair flows the length of sheets, and the oils of our skin blend like two streams joining. This river is clean. On the shore at this moment, the child is clutched on my back, being carried to safety. Thank you for teaching me the power of the word, Maya Angelou and Guy Johnson. This is for Guy Johnson's 50th birthday, and I entitled it When We Meet. And I thought of all the anniversaries that we are commemorating this year, the 20th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, the 50th year since the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Should we not weep for the death of water, the child in flames? What does our heart say when the bird drops from stillborn air and the empty eyes of horses brim with maggots? And too many human bones to bury are heaped in mounds of flame in Hiroshima. How does our heart rest when Oklahoma City bombings, the drowning of sons, the bludgeoning of one woman for whom no one stops to assist, assaults us with paralysis? When does the heart stir? A black wall with names mirrors our bodies as we gape at each life lost. A Vietnam veteran released from Leavenworth displays his wounds exquisitely with his souvenir collection. She had given him her arms to offer comfort in nights of rage, offered her thighs so he might slip into oblivion, and in return he slit her soft belly, severed her arms, strung her ears like jewels around his neck. She offered me lilies, he says, tall grass on the side of mountains, waving ponds of peaceful rice, villages of affectionate children, and in return I gave her napalm, a river that smells of blood. We cannot meet again, he said, with hearts of shrapnel. When does the heart scream? A child so hungry in San Francisco eats vomit from her mother's drunken body. We will meet when poetry is louder than guns, when our throats like wide tunnels echo to a string of ears, and a child's tongue is soothed with clean water, when our hearts shudder to life, stroked by severed arms. We will meet, Guy Johnson. We will meet. Finally, tongues of fire. Tongues of fire. We've made a button for you, Dr. Angelou, and it says, I love women with tongues of fire. And some women whited out the W-O. So it says, I love men with tongues of fire. And it took a while, but it's truly catching on now. It's a very popular button. Tongues of fire upon hearing Dr. Maya Angelou, who moves us to remember you. Your face like yellow roses, you, honey-colored, nappy-haired, curly, straight-haired, crop-shaved, crimped, braided, you remember the way women walked in Descartes with baskets on their heads, graceful like palm trees swaying over golden beaches, you, earth-red-colored faces, comforting as shade, you, brown and electric, bone black as the sands of Kona, living on the cheeks of craters, you remember the heat of creation, you, brilliant in red veils from Bengal, even with lips blue from poison indigo fields, plantations of death. You remember rebellion, burning the slave holds. You, with long black thighs, marching the roads of Selma, opening entrance to buses and schoolrooms, facing racism's gnashing teeth. You remember to laugh. You, with faces of white gardenias, remember the maimed but independent women whose hands, freed from knitting needles and coat hangers, kindle the pathways of choice. Our words, like open wings, soar in spite of the pall of poverty, the despair of shelters where light bulbs are missing, dim rooms of broken mirrors. I look at you and see my possibilities in your beautiful faces. We hold ourselves like candles, whispers of light gather. Suddenly, we are blazing with tongues of fire. Yes.
Mm. Okay. Bravo. That was wonderful. All right.
Okay, my darling. Okay, my darling.
Moment. Mm. The power. This is called the accidental cage. One night out of 13,505 days, and my life was changed. Perhaps all the days that passed changed my life, but if so, they are like submerged sandbars. There is no trace on the surface. This one night stood like an Everest in the jet stream, a numbing wall of ice, by its presence dictating the weather, and I was a leaf swept along by the wind down the abyss. I awoke to the low, distorted sounds of human speech, words mumbled by robots in white coats whose batteries had worn down. Their glassy eyes did not focus on me. I was left on my back, staring at the ceiling. I could not move, turn my head, or speak. A millennia passed as I fought for control of my hands. No response. I yearned to awaken from this nightmare. I am moved every 2 hours to save my skin. It wasn't made for endless lying around. I am exiled to an Elba of my own mind, doomed to study 20 square feet of beige wall or ceiling. My food comes through a tube. I am a prisoner. Rather than leave the thought there, I went on. I should say, when I was paralyzed, and I say this all the time, it was an extremely well-disguised character-building experience. My mother came in, and the doctors were saying such things as, well, he won't walk again, and we're not sure that he's going to live, Dr. Angelo. And she turned to them and said, what do you know? I've gone to a higher authority.
Mm. Yes. Yes.
Rather than leave the thought there, I went on. I should say, when I was paralyzed, and I say this all the time, it was an extremely well-disguised character-building experience. My mother came in, and the doctors were saying such things as, well, he won't walk again, and we're not sure that he's going to live, Dr. Angelo. And she turned to them and said, what do you know? I've gone to a higher authority.
Mm. Yes. Yes. Yes.
I love nepotism. This is called the Psalm of Severed Strings. In the whimsy of art, there are many faces. So fingers entwined with taut strings bring life to the inert. A marionette prances, mimicking animal precision. Clever hands play God to the figure below. As the curtain closes, thrown akimbo or lined in a box, the doll is laid to rest. It awaits its master's tether to rise and dance again. On this sphere of makeshift miracles and mad circumstances, there are marionettes upon which the curtain never closes. They may struggle with only one string to renew spasmodic connections, to make a body that has forgotten itself obey. They strive against flaccid muscles and confused reflexes. Against gravity, they fight to regain that which nature has freely given and fate has stolen away. Theirs is the psalm of severed strings. So they lie in insensate waste, moved and brooded over by others, faces in numerous masks who know not their pain nor isolation. They are transformed into room numbers and stripped of privacy. Yet if spirit remains, a human can still be seen amidst the disobedient flesh. And if the will has fiber, even wood can be made to dance.
Hang it!
So thus, when you see them among the crowds, you have seen the true puppeteers. Each ligament, nerve, and limb is moved with a gossamer thread, all to rejoin life's wild carousel. Janice Mirigatani, when she writes her poetry, she made me see that there's a window into reality, that you can still tap the lyrical sound and talk about what's happening. Unfortunately, I couldn't learn this from my mother, who tried to teach me many times. This is called Oklahoma City, 1995. Shirts coiled on the floor, tossed with a frisbee spin. Stuffed animals grinning from unkempt beds, while fallen plastic heroes lie in a line, a defense against the shadows in the closet. It's a scene from an uncompleted play that will never reach the public stage. Our last token and gift of those now gone. What a strange and haunting present this. So what are we to do with their silent room? Shall we strip away all evidence of the lives that once resided here to create a blank space without a past? Every day's a pattern of changelessness. We march to and fro, to work and back, down the street, up the stairs, across the floor, without ever arriving where we want to be. No longer does the shrill laughter echo. Quiet is the drumming of tiny feet. A gift from God has been stolen, and no man-made court can bring us justice. So what do we do with their cluttered room? Shall we leave the sad disarray untouched to preserve their memory in a crypt just down the hall from where we now pace? In the grating silence, we're not alone. Voiceless companions await our return. Sleep is a friend that stands just beyond reach, and there is no greater foe than wakefulness. We ask you, what do we do with their room? When the child grows past the realm of the nest, this grim question has no strange inertia. Thus we ask, do we give away their toys? About a little love poetry. This is called The Inner Garden. I cut myself when I first met you on the barbed wire beneath your smile.
Okay.
But I climbed the fence anyway. And stood bleeding on a high chaparral. On the surface, we chatted and jousted, juggling and jostling, all to determine where one began and the other ended, a mix of distrusting eyes and eager hands. Underneath this, another world unfolded. Blue mountains towered like jagged fangs above a plain of cactus and stunted Madeira. I forgot myself. I became an explorer. I followed your trail of questions through an upland meadow littered with old affairs and found a pass in the Blue Mountains into a deep valley verdant with old growth. When your leg glided, satin, swan-like from beneath the lilies of your skirt, the flickering tongues of wandering thoughts beckoned me to make the ancient connection. Your eyes had that smoky and timeless look. Born on the blustery winds of abandon, winds that made even the forest quiver with their taut, thrusting fingers, for I had found your inner garden, seen where the purple orchids bloom, pushed through the rusted oaken gate deep within the darkening wood. My senses were filled with color and essence, but there were no paths in this garden. Every place I stepped, something was crushed. If I stood still, vines bound and anchored my feet. There were more roses than I had realized. As I moved, my clothes were snagged by thorns. Even the purple orchids reached for me. I had to escape or be digested. I last saw you surrounded by a pride of young lions, snarling their intent. Gazelle-like, you pranced beyond their reach. The old garden is gone. The new one is secret. That's another love poem. My wife always says, "Is that about me?" Chance meetings and water stories. The cocktail party is a fathomed sea. Plumbed to its lees are charted to the frowns and shallow smiles, its repeated patterns like ripples in a terracotta pool. There was nothing about you that floated to the surface, All was submerged beneath the thin social ice of party chatter. Only a chance look revealed your current. The contained swells of your body shimmered in green crepe like distant hills beyond the deep brown swirling oceans of your expression. And yes, I saw your sea of humiliation. Still, your nameless face swept me from the smug glacial structures of polite company, chancing to be battered on unseen shoals with foam and froth. I presented myself. I could not swim, but still you drew me. Your teasing coastline and angry depths dared me, called me to challenge the surf, to throw my soul in the shifting current. Suddenly, I wished to exchange my insignificance for the moon, to dance that tidal dance with you, to be reflected in your eyes, to surge and rush the darkened shore with you. Ah, but I am not the moon in your eyes. It is but a dream, the hidden desire of a drowning man who wades into the deeps to muffle the rage from a daily monotony. People in suits pass like schools of fish while your eyes watch me struggle on your reef. I say, let the fate and let life's typhoon rend. Let the fate of breakers crest. I have no yearning for placid waters. I'd like to do two more, and then I'm out. I'll let my mom close up. This is called City Life. It's another love poem. My friends all think these are not love poems. We are both dangerous, like the streets at night. Streaks of colored light and flickering darkness. We circle, we faint, we dance. It's a slow jig, a melody belabored in a minor key. Our duet, a ritual of unhappiness, a habit twisted strand by strand in boredom. The known is king. All else is surreal, for we have polished security to its jagged edge. The art is to inflict cuts that bleed easily, yet are healed by the rising sun. Every thrust into the flesh is a legal hit, after which love falls like a scarf to the floor. I would have left her, but I kept wondering, among all the hurtling bodies and marching feet, was there anyone I could possibly love that would hate me less than I hate myself? A riddle constantly interrupted by the alarm. The day passes steadily in distracting routines. The night looms. I gird myself for engagement. When I win, sometimes I really think this is love. Wooden sky. This is the wooden sky, and this my ceiling is alive with the dirge of life. Steps crossing over my head, toilets flushing, sinks straining, the whir of gadgets and muffled interchanges, all of it building to the same unavoidable conclusion. At night, a scream rips away the blanket of sleep. I'm exposed to a cold consciousness. The ceiling is narrating an old story. Sounds of bare feet running, the high-pitched pleading, the dreadful whimpering sound a human makes when beaten. I'm three men. I'm young with the elixirs of indignation and anger pulsing in my temple. I am midlife, fending off cynicism, but outflanked by resignation. I am old. My heart is wrinkled. I am tired. My room turns into a timpani when the body hits the floor. I call the police again. They know me. He's beating her again, I say. They're tired. They've heard this before. They know she won't press charges. They don't even want to dispatch a black and white. Black and white? Black and blue. The colors run together. I hang up. I'm old.
The ceiling doesn't care. It has a story to tell. I hear her body being dragged across the floor. She's still screaming. Am I the only person in the building being driven mad by this? I'm a prisoner in a seashell. I can't get away from the sound. I draw my trusty lead pipe from its place and decide to go upstairs. I have no hope that things will go well. I have never seen these people, yet I know them. Brutality turns us all into dogs. At the stairs, I see the police. He has been arrested, for she is unable to speak in his behalf. I turn away. He's a terrorist. He attacks the unarmed and the unsuspecting, and he deserves a merciless fate. I don't even want to see their faces. I want the silence to swallow them for a while. But the ceiling has other ideas. It creaks vacantly, calling attention to all that is not going on. I am three men, and I must move.
Well, I think I've come all apart here, so that's okay. My Lord. I want to... That's all right. I'm here at the microphone. And if the microphone wasn't here, I'd probably be all right.
Let me have that Robert service. Oh, the Robert service is the light one right there. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. Thanks. My Lord, you all. Oh, thank you. First, thank God, then thank you.
Thank you.
I started teaching Guy Johnson a very deep poem. And I'm going to say some of it tonight because I have a very deep friend here, Bob Truhaft. This is an American poem. If you had your microphone, maybe you can do some of it with me. There are strange things done in the midnight sun. By men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails tell their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. You want to come up here and help me with this? Come on. Come on, Bob Truhaft. Come on. Okay.
And the northern lights have seen
strange sights. But the queerest they ever did see
was that night on the marge
of the Lake Lebarge
when they cremated Sam McGee.
Now, Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows. Why he left his home in the South to roam around the pole?
God only knows.
He was always cold, but the land of gold seemed to hold him.
Like a spell.
Though he'd often say in his homely way,
he'd sooner live in hell.
That's it. On a Christmas day, we were mushing our way
along the Dawson Trail.
Talk of your coal through the parka's fold, it stabbed like a driven nail.
If your eyes you closed,
the lashes froze till sometimes we couldn't see.
It was no fun.
But the only one to whimper
was Sam McGee.
And that very night,
as we lay packed tight in our robes beneath the snow,
and the dogs were fed and the stars overhead were dancing heel and toe,
and he turned to me and, "Cap," said he,
"I'll cash in this trip, I guess.
And if I do, I'm asking that you won't refuse my last request."
Well, we pushed on.
No, he seemed so low. I couldn't say no.
But, and he says with a kind of a groan,
"It's the cursed cold, and it's got right hold till I'm chill clean through to the bone.
It taint being dead. It's the awful dread of the icy grave that hangs.
So I want you to swear,
foul or fair,
you'll cremate my last remains."
Well, a pal's last need is a thing to heed, so I swore I wouldn't fail.
And we started at the stroke of dawn.
God, he looked ghastly pale.
He crouched on the sleigh, and he raved all day of his home in Tennessee.
And before nightfall,
a corpse was all
that was left
of Sam McGee.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much, Bob. That's the best. So we're on these deep, deep thoughts. I was happy to raise this brilliant young man. And what a wonderful thing, 50 years later, my Lord, to stand here among friends of 30, 40 years, among these two fine poets, and to celebrate this 50-year growth of my own and his, and to talk about poetry. Poetry. To hear the phrases which mean so much to me. I mentioned some last night. There's a shred in a 19th century folk song in which a black man spoke of the woman he loved. He said, "The woman I love is fat and chocolate to the bone. And every time she shakes, some skinny woman loses her home." Oh, my Lord. And the lines in the spiritual, it said, there's one line that says, "Green trees are bending, poor sinner stands a trembling." Now, you could say it was in the spring, and there was a breeze coming out of the north, and someone who hadn't done the right thing was standing in a copse of trees and shaking as a consequence. Or you could say it poetically. Green trees are bending. Poor sinner stands a trembling. That is poetry. It seems to me that I have inherited a melody of poetry. So now that I'm finally up here and the other two poets are sitting down. I love the poetry, the rhythmic poetry. And so many years ago, I wrote a number of poems for children. And one is Harlem Hopscotch. And children all over the world jump hopscotch. In Japan, in Sweden, it's called Hoppa Hoka. They jump, dump, dump, jump, dump, dump, jump, dump. But in Harlem, Harlem, New York, Harlem, Oakland, Harlem, Tulsa, when black children jump, the rhythm is a little more complex. It becomes dun, dun, chicka, dun, 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 dun. So I wrote Harlem Hopscotch. 1 foot down and hop is hot.
Good things for the ones that's got. Another jump now to the left. Everybody for himself. In the air, now both feet down. Since you're black, don't stick around. The food is gone, rent is due. Cuss and cry, and then jump too. Everybody's out of work. Hold for three and then twist and jerk. Cross the line, they count you out. But that's what hopping's all about. Both feet down, the game is done. They said you lost, I believe you won. Yeah. Yeah. I don't smoke anymore, but there was a time when I smoked. And I feel now, though it's maybe 8 or 9, 10 years since I've smoked, I think now if I became the kind of person who went, oh, and acted as if I put airplane glue on the back of my hand and stuck it to my forehead and walked around when people smoke, if I started becoming like that, I would go back to smoking, I would chew tobacco and dip snuff. I went into a health food diner in Sonoma years ago. I went in and I was a smoker. I sat down, I wanted some rice and vegetables. I ordered the rice and vegetables. The woman took my order and walked away. And I pulled a fresh package of cigarettes out of my purse. And she ran back to me and said, "Don't you dare." So I said, "I beg your pardon." She said, "How dare, you awful thing, you're trying to kill us." So I said, "Wait a minute now. You don't want me to smoke?" "No, you can't smoke in." So I said, "Well, I mean, why don't you put some signs up?" She said, "Well, we thought a person who would come into a health food store would know better." So I said, "Well, I've worked so diligently to pry myself loose from my illiteracy that I like every chance I can get to see if I can read." But nothing I said would make her smile. So she said, "You have endangered every person in here." I hadn't even pulled that little thing from around. So I looked at the people. I said, "Well, these people just started coming here." She said, "No, they have been, these are regulars. They come for years." So I said, "I wouldn't tell it. I mean, they look like this." I said, "Oh, my, please, my God." So I went home and wrote this. I'm happy to... I'm happy to say that the American Meatpackers Association printed 200,000 copies of this poem. No sprouted wheat and soya shoots and Brussels in a cake, carrot straw and spinach raw. Today I need a steak. Not thick brown rice and rice pilau and mushrooms creamed on toast, turnips mashed and parsnips hashed. I'm dreaming of a roast. Health food folks around the world are thinned by anxious zeal. They look for help in seafood kelp. I count on breaded veal. No smoking signs, raw mustard greens, zucchini by the ton, uncooked kale and bodies frail are sure to make me run to loins of pork and chicken thighs and pork and standing ribs so prime. Pork chops brown and fresh ground round, I crave them all the time. Irish stews and boiled corned beef and hot dogs by the scores, or any place that saves a space for smoking carnivores." Yes. Well, A free bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the currents end and dips his wing in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through the bars of rage. His wings are clipped, his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still, and his voice is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. The free bird thinks of another breeze and the trade wind soft through the sighing trees and fat worms waiting on a dawn bright lawn. And he names the sky his own. But a caged bird stands on the grave of dreams, shadows shouting a nightmare scream. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but long far still, and his tune is heard on a distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. This poem some years ago I was called by Arsenio Hall, who asked me to please come on and do his program. I thanked him, but I said, you know, Mr. Hall, he said, oh no, Dr. Angelo, I'm just a chap. I mean, please just call me Arsenio. Oh no, I just want you to, I said, Mr. Hall, I don't know if I will get along very well with your constituents. I mean, I don't know how I will go over. He was wonderfully persuasive. I did the show, I loved it, and loved him, and still do. And in the end, I found that I liked it so much, I went back to do the show probably 7 or 8 times. The first time, however, I did a little piece of doggerel called 7 Women's Blessed Assurance. well, so when I did the piece, I left Los Angeles. I flew to Geneva, Switzerland. I took a train from Geneva to Brie, and took a train from Brie up the Alps to Zermatt at the foot of the Matterhorn. And there I did a 3-hour lecture. I can do it, really. 3-hour lecture. I won't do it tonight, but I was so full of myself. So when I left there, I stayed 4 or 5 days. I went back to Geneva, and I was standing in the airport when this young white man came up. I had an umbrella, my purse over my shoulder, and a briefcase. And the young white man came up. He said, Dr. Angelo, I said, Jules. He said, Miss Maya Angelo, I said, Jules. He said, Miss Angelo, I was in Los Angeles at Arsenio Hall's show the night you did 7 Women's Blessed Assurance. And I said then, and I say now, woo, woo, woo. Well, so I laughed, of course. And when I straightened up from the laughter, my umbrella was way over there. My purse there, my briefcase back there. The young man was gone. And all those Dour Swiss were looking at me like this. So here's this nice piece. 7 Women's Blessed Assurance. The first woman said, one thing about me, I'm little and low. I find me a lover wherever I go. The second woman said, they call me String Bean. I'm so tall. Men see me and they're ready to fall. The third woman said, I'm fat as butter. I'm sweet as cake. Men start to tremble every time I shake. The fourth woman said, I'm young as morning. I'm fresh as dew. Everybody wants me. Look at you. The fifth woman said, I'm little, I'm low, I'm sweet to the bone. They like to pick me up and just carry me home. The sixth woman said, when I pass 40, I drop pretense because men like women who got some sense. But the seventh woman, for obvious reasons, is my favorite. She said, 55 is perfect. So is 59. Because everybody needs to rest sometime. Hey. Well, what? This last poem, I dedicate this poem to all our mothers, our Asian mothers and our Irish mothers, Native American and Spanish-speaking mothers, our Greek mothers and grandmothers, and Polish and Hungarian, and the African American mothers and grandmothers. My grandmother, who raised me, my maternal grandmother, who when she died was over 6 foot, and Mama, this is a mama. You know Mama, everybody has Mama, I mean, she's Jewish. We got Mama, so Mama would sing in church. Every Sunday, Mama would sing in church. The minister would say, and now we'll be privileged with a song from Sister Henderson. Every Sunday, my grandmother would say, me? And you know, when you're young, no one can embarrass you as much as an adult to whom you're related. God, I would just die. I'd think, Mama, get up and sing. Everybody knows you're going to sing. They even know what you're going to sing. Get up, Mama, and sing. She would look all up in the ceiling and like, what? She sang the same song. Children would be slipping off the pews saying to me, your grandma doing it again. Oh, but finally she would sing. And she sang the same song every Sunday. And she was so good. She could sing so well and with so much passion that at least once every 2 months, some woman in the church would get happy and wind up her whole purse and throw it at the preacher. But at home, when I would ask Mama to sing, I would write, because at that time I didn't talk, so I'd write a note and give it to my grandmother. And she'd put on her spectacles and read. I would have asked her, Mama, please sing. She'd read and she'd say, sister, you go on, you know Mama can't sing. But if I left her alone, she'd sing, I shall not be removed. I shall not be removed just like a tree. I would write, Mama, it is not removed. She would look, she'd say, yes, sister, Mama, no. Just like a tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be removed. She lay skin down on the moist dirt, the canebrake rustling with the whispers of leaves, and the loud longing of hounds, and the ransack of hunters crackling the near branches. She muttered, lifting her head a nod toward freedom, I shall not be moved. She gathered her babies, their tears slick as oil on black faces, young eyes canvassing mornings of madness. Mama, is Master gonna sell you from us tomorrow? Yes, unless you keep walking more and talking less. Yes, unless the keeper of our lives relieves me from all commandments. Yes, and your lives, never mind to live, will be executed upon the killing floor of innocence, unless you match my heart and words and say with me, I shall not be moved. In Virginia tobacco fields, along Arkansas roads, in the red hills of Georgia, into the palms of her chained hands, she cried against calamity. You have tried to destroy me, and although I perish daily, I shall not be moved. Her universe, often summarized into one black man's body, falling finally from the tree to her feet, made her cry each time in a new voice, all my past hastens to defeat. Strangers claim the glory of my love. Iniquity has bound me to his bed, yet I shall not be moved. She heard the names, swirling ribbons in the winds of history, nigger, nigger bitch, heifer, mammy, property, creature, ape, baboon, whore, hot tail, thing, it. She said, but my description cannot fit your tongue, for I have a certain way of being in this world, and I shall not be moved. No angel stretched protecting wings above the heads of her children, fluttering and urging the winds of reason into the confusion of their lives. They sprouted like young weeds. She could not shield their growth from the grinding blades of ignorance, nor shape them into symbolic topiaries. She sent them away, underground, overland, in coaches, barefoot. She said, when you learn, teach. When you get, give. As for me, I shall not be moved. She stood in mid-ocean, seeking dry land, searching God's face. Assured, she placed her five service on the altar. And although clothed in the finery of faith, when she appeared at the temple door, no sign welcomed, black grandmother, enter here. Into the crashing sound, into the wickedness, she said, no one, no 1 million ones dare to deny me God. I go forth alone and stand as 10,000. The divine upon my right impels me to pull forever at the latch of freedom's gate. The Holy Spirit upon my left leads my feet without ceasing into the camp of the righteous, into the tents of the free. These mama and grandmama faces, lemon yellow, plum purple, honey brown, have grimaced and twisted down pyramids of years. She stands today before the abortion clinic, confounded by her lack of choice. In the welfare line, reduced to the pity of handouts, ordained in the pulpit, shielded by the mysteries, in operating rooms, husbanding life, in choir lofts, holding God in her throat, on lonely street corners, hawking her body, in classrooms, loving children to understanding. Centered on the world stage, she sings to her loves and beloveds, to her foes and detractors, however I am perceived and deceived, however my ignorance and conceit, lay aside your fears that I will be undone. For I shall not be moved.
Thank you. that standeth by the water. Oh, I shall not be moved.
May we have lights, please? I shall not
be moved. I shall not be moved. It's like a tree that's standing by the water. I shall not be
coming. Go home and make poems and read poems to each other. Remember, the engine of love is you.